The key word for today, as you read from the lecture notes, which are available to you on the stage, if you haven't picked them up, you can pick them up now or at the end of the lecture, is memnemai. Memnemai. That's item one on the handout. And you notice that I define it as I have total recall. And we'll see that there are all sorts of special contexts in this song culture about where you can say it. Number two of the handout, I loop back to where I ended the last lecture. This is a very typical Greek song culture thing to do, to start something where you left off the time before. But I won't just do the whole Salinger quote, I'll just do the end of the quote. So just the part where it says, many, many men have been just as troubled morally and spiritually as you are right now. Happily, some of them kept records of their troubles. You'll learn from them if you want to. It's a beautiful reciprocal arrangement, and it isn't education, it's history, it's poetry. My emphasis today is on this idea of keeping records. Ordinarily, we think of the written medium, and we say things like, you'll go down in history. I find it interesting that even the word record, when we apply it to, let's say, vinyl records that your generation has already passed by, passed beyond, or the term record store, even though people don't use vinyl records anymore, that word record and the verb to record something, think back about what it really means. It means grabbing the memory, grabbing a memory of something, to store it literally, if you look at the Latin word from which record is derived, to store it in your heart, which in certain cultures is considered the seat of the memory. So I'm very interested in the idea of memory and hoped for total recall inherent even in our English word record. Number three, if I could pursue a little bit further the idea of to record something, to put on record something. If I wanted to give you a quick bird's eye view of ancient Greek song culture, you would see, and you can read this paragraph more calmly in the privacy of your room later, you will see that essentially this culture, as we're studying it, did not rely on the medium of writing the way you and I are accustomed to. And that what there is instead of that medium, especially for the earliest phases of Greek literature, such as the Iliad, which we're studying right now, the number one medium is memory and various mnemonic devices that the song culture has devised in order to retain those important things that must be retained. And if you can just read the last sentence of this paragraph in item three of your handout, what we're essentially studying is the mentality of total recall. In number four, a traditional society where the idea of remembering is the same as the idea of reliving an experience. And those experiences can even include the heroes of the heroic age, which is before the age of the historical period that we're studying. These are the heroes of the Greeks. And the idea is total recall of this era, a total recall of the heroic age by way of the medium as we see represented in the Iliad. And to repeat, this medium is not primarily dependent on writing, it's dependent on mnemonic techniques in a song culture, and our term for it will be oral tradition. Number five, oral tradition. And the key to understanding what oral tradition is not that it is not written. The fact that oral tradition is not written is not the basic thing that defines it. That's just by hindsight, let me assure you. That's purely hindsight. Oral tradition, from the point of view of the song culture in which oral tradition operates, is, as we see in number six, a medium in which composition and performance are aspects of the same process. And in this kind of medium, as you see in number seven, whether you write it down or whether you don't write it down is immaterial. Homeric poetry, the poetry of Homer, as represented in our first big reading, the Iliad, is a medium of remembering, not a medium of writing. The fact that we have it in written form is a historical fact of later cultural eras, and we'll get into that at a later point. The medium calls itself Kleos, number eight. And you remember from last time's lecture, Kleos was our key word for last week. You want to hear what the basic unit of Kleos sounds like? Number eight. The technical term for it is dactylic hexameter. What I thought I would do is just perform for you the first seven lines of the Iliad in the original Greek. As I perform it, you'll notice some interesting things, I hope. One is that this language, the ancient Greek language, is different from the modern Greek language in this regard, has two kinds of accent, stress and pitch. Stress and pitch, and those two work together. And it takes a lot of chutzpah to try to reenact this for you, but I'll try to do the first seven verses with both stress and pitch accentuation. Me. Meni naeda thea thaleia joachileos, ulomenein he muria chayois, alge etheke. Πολλάς δυστήμους ψυχάς αηδίπτοι αψεν, χαρό όν αυτούς τεχελόρια τελχε κυνέσιν, ούιο νόησι καθάσι, διός τεφελέα το βουλέ. Ιστάς τρόε θεόν, φύνε έκε μαχέσταε, λάτους τράι διός φύος, etc. This is the way it sounds. Can you imagine this going on for 15,000 plus verses? Well, it does. And here you are reading it in this medium of writing. Not only that, but you're distanced from this by way of a translation. So we're several steps removed. Yet, what my goal is to try to get back to what the medium must have been like back when we did not have access to writing, when most people did not, and where the primary way for people to get the Iliad, to get the Odyssey, is by way of listening to the performance. If you see in number nine, I thought I would give you an example of how this medium talks about itself, this medium of photo recall, this medium that calls itself Kleos. And I'm taking a passage here from what we moderns think is the most tedious and difficult and maybe even unrewarding part of the Iliad, which is where the narrator, the person who tells the narration, is about to describe everybody who was of any importance who came to Troy to fight on the side of the Greeks, equals the Achaeans, equals the Argives, equals the Danaans. And from the point of view of the song culture, the performer has to get it exactly right, because everybody is listening to how their ancestors, how their cultural ancestors are being represented. So there's this tremendous sense of self-consciousness about, am I going to get it right? Am I going to make any slip? And here's the way the narrator, let's call him the way the Greeks called their cultural hero, Homer. Let's call him Homer. Here's the way Homer talks about this mnemonic task this anxiety of influence that he has. Tell me, Muses, number 9, who live in your Olympian abodes, since you are goddesses and you were there and you know everything, but we only hear the Kleros and we know nothing. Espetemen moi musai, Olympia do matechusai. Tell me, Muses. And then the part where he says, you know the Kleros. You've been there. You saw everything. You heard everything. I know nothing. That part is, Trimes God, Kleros estet, arestete istete panta. You know the Kleros because you were there and you know everything. I know nothing. The narrator doesn't have to know anything because the Muses, who get this, are the goddesses of total recall, the goddesses of memory. They were there, they saw it, they heard it, and then they tell me, the narrator, and I tell you, the audience. You see, that way, it looks as if you, the narrator, don't have to have the experience. All you have to do is hear what the Muses tell you. But in a sense, and this is what I'm elaborating in 9a and 9b, which I hope you'll read carefully, is what seems like a very modest statement. Oh, I don't know anything. I don't have to see a lion to describe what a lion looks like. I don't have to hear the lion roar to describe how a lion roars. I don't have to hear what Diomedes said to be able to quote directly, word for word, syllable for syllable, what he said. I don't have to do that. This seeming modestness about how I don't have to have the experience, it's only the Muses who do, is really an exercise in pride. An exercise in pride and the medium, because the very same singer of Psalms, the narrator of the narration, the narrator with a capital N, in a sense has the authority to speak exactly what was seen by the goddesses of total recall back when in the heroic age. It's not modest at all. It's like saying, I had access to the reality of the heroic age. And in number 10, I invite you to start thinking about the narrator with a capital N, the storyteller who's in charge of the story as the story is being told to you, the audience, at one time in one place, and then various people within the narration who may be telling stories to their audiences. That's precisely what happens in number 11, the moment in book 9 when the old man Phoenix, who is like a mentor to Achilles, the number one hero of the Iliad, where the old man Phoenix is telling Achilles and the assembled heroes a story of heroes who were before their heroic age, because their heroic age is before heroic ages. And this is the way we translate it in number 11. This is the way we learned it, the glories of men who were heroes of old time, about a time when someone was roused to tempestuous fury. In other words, Phoenix, the old man, in telling a story of the heroic past to the hero of the Iliad, is essentially claiming to have total recall of what happened in this earlier time. What is his authority? Well, let's wait and see. Notice where I translated glories of heroes of old time in number 11. Klea andron. Klea is the plural of kleos, which was our key word for last time. Glories. And andron is men in the sense of heroes here. And this idea of the medium referring to the medium as Klea andron, the glories of heroes, and by glories we here mean not just the actual glory, but the medium that confers the glory, which is heroic song. This idea of Klea andron is something that you can see not only in the world of the Iliad, you could see it in the middle of the 20th century in places like Bosnia, in places that we think of in a broad geographical sense as Yugoslavia. In number 11A, I give you a quick thumbnail sketch of my teacher, Albert Lord, who was one of the pioneers of studying oral tradition, living oral traditions that survived into the 20th century. He happened to be my teacher, a teacher of Homer, a researcher in Homer, which is what we're studying, but simultaneously a teacher and researcher in the South Slavic traditions of the early and mid-20th century in places like Bosnia. And he's dead now. I wish he were here to tell you about his research in former Yugoslavia. And I deeply regret that I didn't make more records of him, so to speak, as he was lecturing. I'll show you a clip, Yancy, if you're ready soon. This clip he did for a group of undergraduates. Please listen for the word plea andron, because he'll actually use that word. And you know how it is with records? You have all sorts of nostalgia and regrets. I wish that plastic chair that is right next to him were out of there. I wish I could erase it. I wish it weren't there. It just detracts from the whole scene. I wish I could go back there and take that plastic chair, I remember it, and move it 3 feet over so that it's not in camera range. But anyway, here's Albert Lord, my teacher, talking about plea andron. Okay?
Another informal setting is the coffee house in Muslim communities where men gather, especially during the month of Ramadan, and listen after a day of fasting to epic songs that may continue for a whole night. It was reported by some of Milman Parry's Muslim informants, for instance, Chamil Kulenovich of Kulenbakov, whose father had been a bey, that during the Ottoman rule, the nobility, the agas, beys, pashas, and viziers, sometimes invited epic singers to entertain their guests and might even keep them in their household for some time. Only the last of these settings seems to fit, possibly, the ancient Greek case, except the one figure, and that is of Achilles, sitting in his tent and singing Clea Andron, the deeds of heroes.
And we're going to see that that scene. You'll be reading it in Book 9, when the ambassadors go to the tent of Achilles. And not only do we have people telling Achilles about Clea Andron, there you'll see him with his string instrument, with his lyre, and he is accompanying himself while he is himself, the hero of the Iliad, performing Clea Andron. That's what my teacher is talking about. I also thought it would be interesting for you to see how Albert Lord and his teacher, Milman Parry, and these were both Harvard professors, how they actually managed to make a video as well as audio recording of one of their master singers, one of the master singers whom they recorded. This audio recording is in a technique called kinescope, and you can imagine in the early 1930s that this was already a major leap forward in technology to be able to do this. We have only a few fleeting seconds of this singer, whose name is Avdo, A-V-D-O. He was a master singer who performed for Parry an epic, get this, 12,000 lines plus. When you think of the fact that the Iliad is 15,000 lines plus, you get a sense of the virtuosity of this man in the early 1930s. Again, the video here is very bad. It's from the early 1930s, but it's our one precious trace of this oral tradition, which is, even as we're speaking, dying in the South Slavic area, if not completely dead. Okay, so Yancy, if we could play Avdo.
Asvati Narasputo.
se ava sava se vene tapita e moise te se vene tovi chuko sus vati od koje kraji ne ova ki je u se tam koti na ni jesu to latilija možda anki u te resto prirodi se vene sami peseta se ono su ti pave sirata ka je tan sala o se herbuti ma a drugi je paša o tragu ka na opa konja lopma na ka sala tu o se vene ta onda sala li et peseni jo avaj mene to po kamino gada sam znao gdje su svatita ki uni pa se i kraje svici ne bi pozoni vodio a voli mi noći.
I have such a feeling of nostalgia even looking at this, and in a sense the video fails, excuse me, the video fails after the audio fails, and then it's all failure in the sense that this is gone forever, and this is that one fleeting moment, and it's gone forever. And you have the magic of performance, the magic of the here and now, the magic of bringing the moments of heroes as if they were right now, into the here and now. Did you develop an ear for the medium? This was a 10-syllable song. You can imagine he goes on like this: 10 syllables, 10 syllables, 10 syllables, for 12,000 plus lines. And it basically trochaic, just for the record, da 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 da, 12,000 plus times. I hope this gives you an idea of the power of these words, the power of Thales, and the power of somebody saying, Memne Mai, I have total recall, in the scene in Iliad 9, when the old man tells the younger man how to behave in a heroic world by actually singing an earlier song about earlier heroes. Now, Phoenix is simply a hero in the Iliad. And from the standpoint of an audience from a later stage of Homeric tradition, he's simply one of many heroes. And he's essentially doing a narrative within a narrative. But he's different from the narrator of our Iliad because you notice he doesn't invoke the muse, the goddess of absolute memory, of total recall. Because presumably he's already in that world and therefore his recall is based on personal experience, what other people told him. He has different kinds of dependencies than we do. We are dependent totally on the muses, just as our narrator seems to be totally dependent on the muses. Essentially, what Phoenix, however, is saying is still, I have total recall because I'm using the medium of song, because I am performing Thales. And I go back to something that I was elaborating the last time. It's very important that Thales means not just glory, but the medium that confers glory. So once you're tapped into the medium, you're already in that world. Did you notice when Phoenix introduces his story, as we saw in that part where he says, I'm going to do Clea Andron, did you notice how he describes his audience, that they're philoi? They're philoi, P-H-I-L-O-I. And philoi, as we see in number 13, has that sense of near and dear. We can't deal with an alienated audience in this medium. If the audience isn't connected emotionally as well as intellectually, with the performer, the communication cannot happen. The communication short circuits. You will see that this idea of emotion as a component of the experience that is relived by way of total recall is essential for our understanding the power of the Iliad. The word philoi, near and dear ones, which is how Phoenix presumes to talk to his audience, and the way we are presumed to be as the audience of the Iliad, this term philoi is basically emotional. It's the idea of the audience having to be connected to the performer and even connected to each other in order for the communication to work. You cannot communicate in this medium without community. Community must be presupposed. Now, the story that Phoenix tells is a masterpiece, number 14, of compression. And compression, as I was already telling you in the last lecture, is one of the features of oral tradition, is you can tell a narrative in a very expanded way, 15,000 plus verses, or you can tell it in a very compressed way. Last time we met, we saw one that was essentially one verse long. You can compress it that far. And since this story that Phoenix is telling Achilles is supposed to point the way for how Achilles, as the hero of the Iliad, should behave, I submit to you that if we read the story of Phoenix, we're going to get a bird's eye view of what the heroic values of this heroic medium really are. So it's good to pay attention to it. And I don't want to give away the story, because I can hardly wait for you to read it and for you to be discussing this in the first meeting of sections, which is what you will be already doing in part. All I want to do is to say that one of the key characters in this story, and I give it to you in number 14, is a character called Cleopatra. Not the Cleopatra of historical times who had a fling with Julius Caesar. This is a Cleopatra of the heroic age. And as we'll see later, her name is very important. What she does is very important. And just to get you started, I'll tell you the most important thing that he does in this story within a story. She cries. She weeps. Or may I use the term that is most appropriate to this Greek song culture, she laments. Because remember that in Greek song culture, to lament, to sing a song of lament, and to cry, to weep, to have tears flowing from your eyes, those things are not incompatible. I was talking about these great Harvard professors of the past, like Milman Parry, who unfortunately died under mysterious circumstances in the early 30s, then Albert Lord, who died in 1991. I'm happy to say that some of these great pioneers of oral tradition are still here at Harvard. One of them is my dear colleague Margaret Alexiou, who happens to be a specialist in the study of women's laments in Greek tradition. And I suppose it wouldn't even hurt to say that she's teaching a course in Greek laments right now at Harvard on Wednesdays, what is it, from 4 to 6? If you're interested in a course like this, email me right away. Remember, my email address is on the syllabus. So I'm saying this kind of research is going on at Harvard right now, especially women's laments. And the climax of the story of Phoenix, and we'll see how this is relevant to the Iliad, has to do with a woman crying, a woman lamenting, and we'll see what she's lamenting about later. Because I'm showing Blade Runner to you tonight, I thought it would be interesting for you to see how this movie happens to touch on various themes that are treated by the Iliad unintentionally, but touches on them in such an incisive way that I find it a wonderful conversation starter for trying to understand what the emotional agenda of the Iliad are and how that turned into moral agenda. So, Yancy, if we could do just the very beginning of Blade Runner, this is a little sneak preview. This copy isn't all that great. Now, what you're going to see is a giant eyeball, and the giant eyeball is looking at the Iron Age of today. Actually, it's science fiction, so it's tomorrow. And there are these horrific views of the world of technology and how technology can destroy all of life. And this eyeball, as it's looking at it, I don't think you'll be able to see it on this screen, but you can imagine it, is, are you ready? Suffused with tears. So already the eyeball that is looking at the scene, which is the way the story, the narrative of Blade Runner opens, the eyeball is already suffused with tears. And if an ancient Greek saw this, they'd say, aha, lamentation, a woman's point of view. Now we'll have to discuss tonight whether it's a woman's eyeball or a man's eyeball, but let's take a look at it. Immediately afterwards, Yancy, I don't think we should even stop. So when they're doing the eyeball, then we'll go immediately to another little clip, which says, are you ready? Implants, just implants. I told you I'd talk about implants. And of course, I like it because implants makes me think of the way the singer of tales, the narrator of the Iliad, says, look, it's all here in my brain. My brain is directly connected to what the muses saw and heard. Only here, it's yet this Harrison Ford telling Rachel the replicant, all those wonderful memories that you have of growing up and your childhood memories of all the happiness that you experience, those are just implants. This is typical Philip K. Dick science fiction writing. You know, this is the same man who did Total Recall. It just so happens that Philip K. Dick, the author of the printed version of what became Blade Runner, also wrote something called Total Recall, where the idea is that in the future, you can have an operation where you have implanted in your head a very happy moment that you spent in Hawaii. If you were never in Hawaii, it's somebody else's happy moments, but they're implanted in your head. So you think that it's your experience, and you're experiencing this happiness. A very grim view of media. So here's this Harrison Ford figure who's telling Rachel, who thinks she's a human, that all those happy moments that she had in childhood, that happiness, implants. But you'll see what trips up the Harrison Ford figure is that one of the ways that Rachel can experience her own past is not just memory per se, but memory by way of playing the piano. We'll get to that in a minute, but first let's see the eyeball suffused with tears, and then let's look at Harrison Ford trying to destroy the memory world of this person who thinks she is human, but maybe she's not human.
Replicant, don't you? Look. It's me with my mother.
Yeah? Remember when you were six? You and your brother snuck into an empty building through a basement window that you were going to play doctor? He showed you his, and when it got to be your turn, you chickened and ran. Remember that? Did you ever tell anybody that? Your mother, Tyrell, anybody? You remember the spider that lived in the bush outside your window? Orange body, green legs. Watched her build a web all summer. Then one day there's a big egg in it. The egg hatched.
The egg hatched?
Yeah.
100 baby spiders came out. And I ate her.
Implants. Those aren't your memories. They're somebody else's. They're Tyrell's nieces.
Okay, so now she's very upset because he's tearing down her memories, right? And she's showing these pictures. Look at me as a little girl. Here are my happy memories. Looks at those pictures. Those aren't your memories. Those aren't your family. They're the family of the scientist who created you. All those happy moments are the niece's memories, the scientist's niece's memories, not your memories. But now, how about if Rachel takes music lessons or socially trains? What happens if she starts playing the piano? In a sense, whose memories are they now? You see, once you get into song culture, if I can put it that way, once you get into music, then how are you to say whose experience it really is? Because through music, or let's say it in the Greek way, through song, you really relive experiences that may not be yours, but become yours. Well, let's take a look at this scene. And Yancy, if we could play this. This happens almost immediately after that previous scene.
Music.
I didn't know if I could play. I remember lessons. I don't know if it's me or Terrell's niece.
You can play beautifully.
Even if you've never seen Blade Runner, I hope this gets you interested and you'll want to come tonight. Now, something that's, I think, very relevant to what I'm going to show you tonight is, well, this isn't perhaps the best print that we're going to see. Also, it's not the director's cut. It's the commercial cut. And I welcome the commercial cut over the director's cut, because the director's cut is so subtle that even after having seen this film dozens of times, I miss things if I just look at the director's cut. I'll give you a very good example, which is exactly relevant to this clip. You'll see a scene tonight where the Harrison Ford figure says he's at a sushi bar. And so he's being served sushi, and he says, "Sushi. That's what my ex-wife used to call me. Cold fish." Now you'd think that it was enough for him to say, "Sushi, that's what my ex-wife used to call me." He's already at a sushi bar, so you don't need to say cold fish. But I kind of welcome it, because this is like the narrator driving home the point that the figure, the Blade Runner figure, Deckard, is a cold fish. He has a very hard time connecting with any kinds of emotion. And now get this, if you see the director's cut, he goes to the sushi bar, he sits down, and then you're supposed to figure this out just by looking at the expression on his face. I'm sorry, I just can't do it. But I can also tell you that the medium that we're about to study, the Iliad, has that kind of subtlety. In other words, once you start getting into this medium, and you can do it simply by relentlessly reading on, not getting stuck at any one given point, just press ahead, you will start seeing this world of heroes emerging for you. One particular thing about Greek emotions, ancient Greek emotions, other than our emotions, that I'd like to focus you on right now, and I think this will be, in a curious way, highlighted by the film, so we can talk about this tonight if you want, is what Greek philosophers call fear versus pity. And I don't think when we hear fear and pity, we think of those two emotions as somehow symmetrical with each other or as two sides of the same coin. What I want to get you to thinking about is how, from the point of view of the ancient Greeks, fear is when you're looking at somebody suffering and you're repelled by it. You want to run away from it because you're identifying with that suffering. You don't want that suffering to happen to you. Okay, so that's fear. Pity would be looking at that same suffering and wanting to reach toward that person, get closer to that person rather than farther away from that person. So it's almost like the two different ways that magnetic field goes. It's attraction versus repulsion. And it's not that it's exclusively one or the other. There's the sense of how to respond to suffering. Notice that I'm saying it's not exactly one way or the other way. In the classical period, one of the things that song culture explores and explores and explores is what happens within yourself when you have two opposite emotions struggling within you when you're experiencing anything. And it can be things like fear and pity, it can be anger, it can be happiness. You can start, so to speak, mixing the chemistry of what emotions are going through yourself. And in point of fact, what Greek song culture does is explore the whole gamut of these emotions. This is one of the things that this medium specializes in, is exploring emotions, exploring experience. And guess what? This is kind of hard for us to imagine, but classical opera was invented in the Renaissance to bring back this Greek ideal. And when you start thinking of classical opera and opera in general as a way for music to explore the chemistry of emotions, sorting them out, putting them back together, sorting them out again, you start getting a real feel for the classical heritage. That is why in this course, besides clips from popular media, I will hope to use a great many clips from classical opera, from classical ballet, anything I can get my hands on to help us develop a sensitivity for media, such as the ancient Greek medium, which precisely explore human experience by way of vicariously living it, by way of projecting you back to the time and place that is being narrated, which is not just a story, it's not just a narration, it is a reliving of an experience. And the key, I think, for today's lecture, and I will weave in Blade Runner as I wind up this lecture, is the idea that when you look at that last clip we saw, where Rachel, whose own identity has been shaken, she's no longer sure whether everything that she is the emotional world of herself or that of Tyrell's niece. Nevertheless, finds a way of connecting directly with real, absolute experience by playing the piano, by connecting with music. Because that's the beautiful thing about music. And what does music come from? It comes from the word muse, the goddess of absolute memory, the goddess of total recall. The beauty about music, the beauty about the song culture that we're studying, is that it universalizes human experience. It makes it immaterial what your precise background is. Once the performance starts tuning in to the world of heroes, you are pulled into that absolute world. And for the song culture, it is an absolute world. And the world of heroes will then reshape your own experiences, reshape your own life. I mentioned fear and pity, and this is where I will end. Again, I'm not saying that the movie maker of Blade Runner was thinking of Aristotle's theory of fear and pity and catharsis of emotions and all those other things that we will be talking about when he did the dying scene, whoops, did I give the plot away, of one of the replicants. The replicant you saw the last time. But what I want you to look for when you see it tonight is the mixture, the conflict of fear and pity. Especially when Roy says, and I think this would be a good place to stop, think about the word fora from last time, the right time and the right place. Think about the hero as somebody who's struggling with the right time and right place. Think about Klaus as the medium that is capturing the struggle of a human about reaching the right time and right place. And to quote Roy, all those moments will be lost in time, like tears in rain, time to die. The next thing is we have the music to capture that, time to die. Thank you.